Her voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Mathalu alladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Local Afghan officials say Bagram Airfield, which is the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan, has come under rocket attack. A group of British MPs warn that the country is not ready for Brexit, arguing some decisions on infrastructure have been taken too late. And a new official report says U.S. police used excessive force to stop protests against police racism and brutality in New York in summer. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumisha Ahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. A group of British MPs have warned that Britain has not yet provided all the complex IT systems and port infrastructure needed to ensure Brexit runs smoothly. The group said they were concerned about the overall state of readiness. They warned that some decisions on infrastructure have been taken too late. London and Brussels should clinch an agreement by the end of this month. That is when a transition period following the UK's January withdrawal expires. The two sides want each other to compromise on key sticking points regarding their future trade. Both have raised the possibility of a no-deal Brexit.
Before entering his latest and perhaps last round of negotiations with UK counterparts, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, addressed the European Parliament early on Friday morning.
Nous sommes à un moment de vérité.
It is the moment of truth.
Il nous reste,
we have very little time remaining, just a few hours to work through these negotiations in a useful fashion if we want this agreement to enter into force on the 1st of January.
There are less than 2 weeks to go before Britain might crash out of the Brexit transition period without a crucial EU trade deal.
Shameful UK government strategy.
Some EU lawmakers are in no doubt as to which side is to blame for the deadlock.
The UK government is taking endless time to realise that some illusions of Brexit simply cannot be delivered.
Many legislators claim the UK faces financial ruin if Boris Johnson's government fails to reach an agreement with the EU. Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom. It has been pointed out that long delays can already be witnessed at EU-UK border crossings.
Dear British friends, is this what you voted for? Passport stamps and lorry queues? This moment is a victory for Europe.
But the European Union is in no position to gloat, it has been argued.
The real division isn't between the EU and the UK. It's between the haves and the have-nots. And we start dealing with that, or there'll be a lot more Brexits to come.
Deal or no deal, business groups say the EU needs to pursue major structural reforms, especially in the context of Brexit.
there's a mismatch clearly. So we need better mobility. We need to be able to match the supply with the demand for workers across Europe, not just within member states.
Fishing rights remain the major sticking point in the negotiations. One EU lawmaker has reminded Boris Johnson that his closest ally will soon be history. The COVID-19 pandemic is still here, and so he should choose his next moves carefully. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Catalonia's parliament has approved an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders and pro-independence supporters. They are facing legal action in Spain's courts following the 2017 unilateral referendum on independence. Separatist lawmakers plan to push the bill through Spain's Congress next March.
The Parliament of Catalonia Friday approved an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders and the thousands of pro-independence supporters who were facing legal action for taking part in Catalonia's independence drive. The bill, which upholds amnesty and the right to self-determination as prerequisites to end the conflict, was backed by lawmakers from the three separatist parties who plan to push it through Spain's Congress next March. Although lawmakers are aware that the bill has no chance of passing the floor of Congress in Madrid, they went on with it. Gerard Artigas, a parliamentary reporter, explains some of the reasons behind their move.
They know the law will not pass because the socialists in Madrid made clear they will not back it. They went on with it nonetheless, thinking that the Spanish Congress might be the right place to raise the debate on amnesty. Besides, they want to bring the bill to the Congress in order to force all parties to take a position vis-a-vis amnesty, while at the same time they seek to take advantage of the Congress to sensitize the wider public about the jailed leaders.
Pro-Spanish unity parties in Catalonia's parliament vetoed the bill and dismissed the separatist claim of Spanish state repression in the northeastern region.
To approve the amnesty bill would mean admitting that Spain has been a dictatorship, and nobody buys that. All Western democracies recognize Spain as an equal, with its defects and virtues, but as an equal. Nobody in the international community is going to accept that in Spain there are political prisoners or repression, and therefore there is no room for amnesty.
Over the past 3 years, human rights NGO Amnesty International has repeatedly called on Spain to release two of the nine jailed Catalan leaders who have been sentenced for 9 years for sedition, a crime the NGO described as, quote, vague and against the principle of legality. Gusay Kedri, Barcelona.
Now, local Afghan officials, as we've told you, say that the main U.S. airbase in the country has come under attack. At least five rockets reportedly targeted the Bagram airfield north of Kabul. We're joined by our correspondent, Amin Alami, for more details.
Well, the past 24 hours were tough hours for all, including military forces and civilians in Afghanistan. In a recent incident, according to Wahida Shahkar, the spokeswoman of Parwan governor, five rockets were fired on Bagram Air Base, that is the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Bagram district is located in Parwan province. Wahida Shahkar confirmed that these rockets were fired from Kalandar Khel area of Bagram district of Parwan province, but she did not comment regarding to the possible casualties of this rocket attack in Parwan province of Afghanistan, that is located in north of Kabul. U.S. officials and U.S. sources, including officials in Bagram military air base, as well as U.S. embassy here in Kabul, have also not commented regarding to this recent attack there in Parwan province. In the meantime, Afghanistan's defense ministry, as well as Afghanistan's interior ministry, also did not comment regarding to this issue. But let's not forget that this is not only Parwan province where witnessed such rocket attacks over the past 24 hours. According to officials, a heavy car bomb blast that happened in Gilan district of Ghazni province claimed the lives of 15 civilians, 12 of them were children, and wounded 20 others. According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, the Taliban militants were behind launching this attack, but the Taliban militant group has not commented regarding to this stance of Afghanistan's Interior Ministry. But let's not forget that
In a separate incident, again, in northeastern Badakhshan province of Afghanistan, the police chief of Argu district was killed by armed men. On the other hand, another police force was killed in the second part of Kapisa province in Kuhistan area, and Afghanistan's Interior Ministry confirmed that this police force was also shot dead by unarmed men. In northern Afghanistan as well, in Faryab province, according to military sources there, Afghan military forces have defused a vehicle packed with explosives, and the Taliban militants had planned to launch a very huge car bomb attack by using this vehicle. But as I mentioned, according to military sources in northern Faryab province of Afghanistan, Afghan military forces successfully defused this vehicle and avoided a very large explosion there in northern Afghanistan. Generally, we can say that such incidents happen in Afghanistan. I mean, the rise of violence, assassinations, bloodshed, and targeting civilians, while both negotiating teams of the Afghan government and the Taliban militant group has recently agreed to take a break and resume the talks back in resume the talks again in January 5th. But in the meantime, the Afghan government and many other independent bodies, mainly rights bodies and civilians, have strongly called on the Taliban militant group to at least approve a reduction in violence if they are not agree with a long-lasting ceasefire in this country. But the Taliban militants have so far ignored to approve such proposal by the Afghan government, the people of Afghanistan, and rights bodies.
Thank you very much, Amin Alami, our correspondent from Kabul, with the latest updates regarding the attack that happened on a military base, the U.S. largest military base, air base, actually, in the capital, Kabul. A U.S. congressional report says aircraft manufacturing giant Boeing manipulated recertification tests of its 737 MAX model. The report from the Senate Commerce Committee accuses officials from Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration of setting a predetermined outcome for the tests. It says the officials inappropriately coached pilots during the latest assessment of the model. The report concluded that the aircraft manufacturer and the regulatory body tried to cover up vital information on what could have led to two fatal crashes. Boeing is still facing a criminal probe into the 2018 and 2019 incidents, so which claimed over 340 lives. Last month, the FAA approved the 737 MAX's return to service. The New York Police Department is found to have used excessive force to stop protests against police racism and brutality in summer. New York City's Department of Investigation said the police use of excessive force and crowd control tactics fueled tensions during the protests. It also said that officers made mass arrests, used batons and pepper spray, and beat protesters indiscriminately. The report noted that these measures impinged on the protesters' rights to assemble and express their views. The investigation was called in May after social media were flooded with videos of officers' violence, including, in one instance, ramming police vehicles into a crowd of protesters. The rallies were part of the protests over the police killing of unarmed African-American George Floyd, which soon morphed into the worst civil unrest in the U.S. in decades. To discuss that further, we're joined by Alexander Azadgan, Professor of International Political Economy and Senior Geopolitical Analyst. Thank you very much, Mr. Azadgan. It's a pleasure to have you with us once again here on Press TV. Now, this police report, or this actually investigation on the police, do you think it is a good sign? Are we going to see any changes in the way police is treating ordinary people, particularly protesters? Will we see any indictments?
Thanks for your invitation. It's always good to be with you and our global audience. I don't think so. The quick answer to your question is no. I don't think we're going to see any improvement. People often ask me, with the coming into power of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, things may be different because they will come from a reconciliatory background instead of a rabble-rousing techniques and tactics that we have seen from Donald Trump. I think before I answer that question, our audience needs to understand that humanity is going through this great shift in consciousness in a collective way. There's a lot of tug of war that goes with this elevation. And I think a lot of people just plain out don't want to see the African American man being the master of his own destiny. There's a saying that nothing scares a racist more than a black man on a horse. Why? Because he has to look up at it. Black people are fed up just being downright murdered in front of cameras, and nothing really substantive being done to the police officers is a moral outrage. Of course, the majority of officers, we are told, are good people, kind people, law-abiding themselves, but the bad apples seem to really be getting away, you know, literally with murder. And part of that is because of the way the police unions are set up. They want to make sure these people are just not fired so they can get away with what they're getting away with. But from a greater picture, we are in the midst of a revolution. This is this is apparent to everyone who has the eyes to see and the wisdom to understand. The Black Lives Movement, I think, has touched upon some very sensitive things that somehow were ignored more or less during the presidency of President Obama. I believe he was too reconciliatory. He wanted to play both sides of the fence, and now they're coming out in full force. They're fed up. They're tired. The plight of young African-American men being killed. I tell my own students that, you know, if you get pulled over by a cop and you get the feeling that the cop is emotional or in a combative state of mind, don't challenge him, because he just wants to kill you, and most likely he will get away with it. So just try to abide by his instructions and don't trigger him because he wants to be triggered in order to justify his aggression and racism.
Thank you very much, Alexander Azadgan, Professor of International Political Economy and Senior Geopolitical Analyst. The United States is well known for its reluctance to institute a strong social safety net, but the coronavirus has upended its quality and costs of childcare. Ramin Mazahari has more from Chicago.
The situation for childcare in the United States was already perhaps the worst in the Western world. Only Ireland spends less on its children. The average annual price is higher for childcare than for university tuition, and the cost is second only to a family's rent or mortgage. That was before Corona hit. This year, childcare costs have soared nationwide a backbreaking 60%, according to the Center for American Progress, but it has doubled or almost tripled in big cities. Plenty of households weren't prepared for any childcare costs at all. But many free public schools have been shuttered for months due to Corona. The huge price increase has caused parents to quit their jobs just to watch their children and produced financial anxiety for even moderately comfortable households.
Staying home shouldn't be an oath of poverty. You know, if you can afford private childcare, great. Let's have public childcare that's decent and affordable and facilitates people and protects families, because, you know, childcare should be a right.
The federal government's only household relief package this year gave qualified parents just $500 per child. That covers just a few weeks of childcare. It's not just financial. The upending of supervision programs for minors is being called a huge setback in early development and child safety. In cities like Chicago, a minor is 25 times more likely to die from murder than from coronavirus. But closed schools can't provide any structure, and so 2020 has seen a huge increase in juvenile violence and crime.
It's been very stressful on children, and there's been a lot of fallout. I think there's a lot of fallout with a lot of drug therapies being used at younger and younger ages for children. I wonder how that would be if we had better child care and more child care. There's more young people, depression, suicide. And I wonder again how much of this is a result of lack of affordable child care.
Despite the increased cost for parents, the scientific data, and the negative effect on child learning, many in the U.S. want schools to remain closed until autumn 2021. The average parents can only wonder how they'll be able to foot that bill. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
The brutalization of Soleiman Fakhri, prisoner, was a manifestation of the violence endemic in Canada's carceral system, while the state's investigation exemplifies the fortress of impunity placed around it, much as in the U.S. criminal legal system, says Aziza Kanji, writer, in an article published under the heading, Canadian Guards Beat a Prisoner to Death 4 years Ago. Now they have impunity. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. December 15th marks yet another anniversary in the calendar of carceral violence, the killing of Soleiman Fariri, who was beaten to death by guards in an Ontario solitary confinement cell in 2016. This August, almost 4 years later, the Ontario Provincial Police announced that no one will be charged. Fariri was 30 years old. He had studied environmental engineering at a university before being diagnosed with schizophrenia following a car accident in 2004. At the time of his death, he was being held in Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, pending trial for assault. He was placed in solitary confinement despite his diagnosis, a violation of the United Nations Convention Against Torture. On his 10th day in solitary, Fariri was viciously beaten to death, in the words of an eyewitness, by a group of guards sent into his cell to pacify his agitation and distress. The coroner's post-mortem report found over 50 blunt impact trauma injuries, covering almost every area of his body. Guards had pepper sprayed Fariri in the face and then covered his head with a spit hood, trapping the irritant in his airways, and allegedly held him down with a knee to his neck. Practices linked to death by asphyxiation in police custody, including recently those of George Floyd and Daniel Prude in the United States of America. The brutalization of Fariri was a manifestation of the violence endemic in Canada's carceral system, while the state's investigation exemplifies the fortress of impunity placed around it, much as in the U.S. criminal legal system. Even such basic details as the number of officers who participated in the beating, somewhere between 6 and 20, remain unknown. Police failed to interview the eyewitnesses quoted above, who came forward, it fell to the media to uncover his testimony. The coroner's report, despite finding the massive extent of injury, somehow still concluded that the cause of death was unascertained. Reportedly, the official reason given to the Fariri family is that no one can be charged because it is impossible to determine which participant in a mass beating struck the fatal blow. This conflicts directly with the case law established for non-state perpetrators of violence. In 2011 case of R.V. Ball, the British Columbia Court of Appeal confirmed that where co-perpetrators engage in a deadly assault, the Crown need not prove which of the attackers struck the fatal blow or blows. This principle has been pithily stated in concrete terms that the blow of one is in law the blow of all of them. Terrorism prosecutions under Canadian law can proceed preemptively, even when no violence has been anywhere close to occurring at all. Indeed, only 2 out of the 54 completed terrorism prosecutions in Canada so far have involved any actual act of violence, and neither of those caused any death or significant injuries. White supremacist massacres like the 2017 Quebec Mosque shooting haven't been charged as terrorism. On the other hand, many of these terrorism prosecutions have involved state informants central to manufacturing the prosecuted plots. And as in the United States, those identified as vulnerable due to mental illness have been favorite targets for elaborate and expensive stings. This logic of mass incrimination is the exact inversion of the logic of mass exculpation applied to state violence. With non-state terrorism, the blows of none are converted into the guilt of the many. At the opposite pole of absurdity, when it comes to the state, the blows of the many are vaporized into the guilt of none. In settler states like Canada, the field of pain and death is not just metaphorical but material. The terrain on which Canada's police stations, courthouses, prisons, and jails are constructed is colonized indigenous land. The right to discipline and punish built on genocidal negation of the indigenous sovereigns, whose governance systems long predate Canada's own. Canada's prisons and jails are part of a vast and shape-shifting carceral archipelago, which perpetually finds new ways to enforce the dominant rule. Residential schools are now shuttered and declared national historic sites, but indigenous children continue to be seized en masse by child welfare at higher rates than at the height of the residential schools, while the new residential schools of the prison system confine and torture ever-growing numbers of indigenous people behind bars. Enslavement was officially outlawed in Canada by the British Empire in 1834, but the widespread identity of black and brown temporary migrant workers from the global south endures, while incarcerated laborers toil in prison work programs for the typical wage of 30 cents an hour. The Ontario government has finally apologized without accepting criminal liability to those who suffered decades of torture, rape, and abuse in asylums like the Hurnia Regional Center, originally called the Orillia Asylum for Idiots, but the institutional terrorization of those deemed mentally ill like Fakiri persists. The role once performed by asylums has largely now been taken over by prisons and jails. Like Fakiri, one-third of those incarcerated in Ontario last year had a mental health alert on file, up from 7% 2 decades ago. Also, like Fakiri, more than 70% of all people jailed in Ontario are legally innocent, on remand awaiting trial. The ranks of legally innocent incarcerated and dying in provincial jails continue to swell even as government-reported crime rates decline. Imprisonment is increasingly untethered from the official justification of punishing legally ascribed guilt. This exposes even more nakedly mass incarceration's ideological function as an abstract site into which undesirables are deposited, relieving us of thinking about real issues afflicting those communities from which prisoners are drawn in such disproportionate numbers. As renowned scholar and dissenter Angelo Davis writes, the prison has become a black hole into which the detritus of contemporary capitalism is deposited. Mass incarceration is structured to not only target mental illness but to intensify it. This is exemplified by the pervasive use of solitary confinement, the hole within the black hole, identified as one of the predominant methods of psychological torture by the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. Solitary confinement produces discernible disruptions to brain patterns similar to those caused by physical brain injury after only a few days. Hallucinations, delusions, and perceptual distortions are common. The mind's response to the alternative reality of solitary cell. Individuals in solitary have gouged their eyes, stuck objects through their skin, tried to strangle themselves and set themselves on fire. An externalization of the internal anguish solitary engenders. Prisoners describe isolation as an entombment and a living death. According to the CIA, psychological torture is often more devastating or, from their perspective, effective than physical torture. Whereas pain inflicted on a person from outside himself may actually focus or intensify his will to resist, his resistance is likelier to be sapped by pain which he seems to inflict upon himself. 3 years before Fakhri was killed at Central East, another prisoner, Lawrence Prindible, died by suicide in segregation cell at the same jail. In both cases, psychosocial death by solitary was a prelude to biological death. As with incarceration in general, the particular tortures of solitary are systematically visited disproportionately on same. Indigenous people, black people, and people diagnosed with mental illness. In some situations, U.S. counterterrorism prosecutions, for instance, solitary confinement is used deliberately as a coercion tactic to extract guilty pleas by turning the psychological screws. In other situations, equally grotesquely, the torture is simply by a byproduct of mass incarceration's human warehousing function. Even supposed care may end up being torture in another guise. In the name of containing the coronavirus pandemic, hundreds of federal prisoners, including many testing negative, were locked up incommunicado in solitary cells for almost 24 hours a day without access to showers, fresh air, family members, lawyers, or phones. Yet the Canadian federal government claims, in response to legal challenges, that it no longer practices solitary confinement at all. Instead, the same old segregation cells have been rechristened as structured intervention units, little more than solitary by another name. Aliases for solitary confinement proliferate: administrative segregation, special handling, special needs, therapeutic range, and now structured intervention units. While the underlying reality remains largely unchanged. In Ontario's jails, meanwhile, the number and length of detentions in solitary have continued to rise, even in the wake of damning reports by official investigators. Segregation placements, defined as 22 hours per day in isolation, are meant to be periodically reviewed, but this requirement is circumvented by restarting the clock every time an individual is transferred to a different facility or allowed 121 minutes, exactly 1 minute, over the threshold outside the isolation cage. As in Fakhri's case, the fragmentation of the total system of violence between different actors, labels, locations, and time periods enables the perpetration of injury without accountability. Even the most progressive judicial decisions on solitary confinement in Canada restrict themselves to refining its administration instead of abolishing it. For example, the common standard of a 15-day time limit endorsed recently by the Ontario and British Columbia Courts of Appeal would have done little to help someone like Fakhri, who was in solitary for only 10 days before he died. perversely, many attempts to improve conditions of confinement in solitary or to limit its imposition on some vulnerable groups have been reformist efforts, ultimately bolstering the legitimacy of the existing system, criminologist Pramit Rader warns. What differentiates this highly organized system of terrorization from what is commonly called terrorism, represented as the paradigmatic category of illegitimate violence? Many of the features cited to distinguish terrorism from state violence, in fact, testify to the state's far greater capacity to inflict harm. Terrorism is criminalized in expansive and absolute terms. State violence is perpetrated in the name of the law. Terrorism is defined as violence against civilians for political or ideological purpose. State violence, including mass incarceration, exalts and obscures itself as apparently apolitical and non-ideological, a part of the seemingly natural order of the world. Terrorists are depicted as extremist individuals. State violence is committed through a vast and complex network of actors and institutions. So structurally entrenched, their brutality appears banal or even benevolent. Courts castigate some of the cruel and unusual excesses of mass incarceration, while the all-too-usual cruelties proceed unabated behind carceral walls. And so, charities are listed as terrorist entities for donating medical equipment to Gaza, while governments arming civilian massacring regimes like Saudi Arabia is considered business as usual. Indigenous land and climate defenders are impugned as eco-terrorists for burning tires in protest of colonial pipelines, while powerful governments and corporations torch the planet largely unchecked. Security experts speculate about chemical and biological terrorists attacking our water supplies, while decades of government-sanctioned mercury water contamination poisons indigenous communities like grassy narrows. It is the terror cell, not the prison cell, that is imagined as emblematizing the terror threat. The impunity for the torture and killing of Soleiman Faghouri demonstrates yet again that there is little justice to be found from the criminal justice system responsible for the crime. The system that inscribes terror with one hand while wiping its slate clean with the other.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
European News Bulletin.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. My name is Saeed Purza. Our top story, with only hours to go before yet another Brexit deadline, the European Union and the United Kingdom are still in deadlock. Neither side seems to prepare to budge over the two main sticking points, access to the UK's fishing waters and the so-called level playing field for businesses. The UK is trying to get the deal done before the new year, but the country's prime minister has warned a no-deal Brexit is very likely.
The EU's chief negotiator says there is a chance of getting a Brexit agreement, but the path to such an agreement is very narrow. Both sides are calling for compromise. The UK wants EU boats to lose automatic access to British fishing waters, but the EU says if that happens, the UK will have to pay.
Nous l'acceptons et nous le respectons. Mais si le Royaume-Uni veut...
If the United Kingdom wants, after a credible, sufficient period of adjustment, to be able to cut off access to its waters for European fishermen when it wants to, the European Union needs to have sovereign rights to react or to compensate that.
Mr. Barnier says the EU will not sign a deal that will undercut its single market of 450 million consumers. For its part, the UK says it cannot agree to become the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control of its fisheries. Westminster certainly doesn't want nearly $1 trillion worth of EU-UK trade to be hit with tariffs and quotas beyond December 31st. And so, hours before yet another deadline, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has warned that a no-deal scenario is very likely unless the EU position changes substantially.
The UK's got to be able to control its own laws, it's what people voted for, and we've also got to be able to control our waters and our fishing rights. It's obviously also what people voted for, and no sensible government is going to agree to a treaty that doesn't have those two basic things in it, as well as everything else. Our door is open. We'll keep talking. But I have to say that things are looking difficult.
Meanwhile, long queues are forming as trucks and lorries try to cross into continental Europe. Logistics companies have reported a surge in demand for imports ahead of a potential no-deal Brexit as companies rush to stockpile. If a deal is not reached by the 31st of December, the UK will have to start trading on World Trade Organization rules. Boris Johnson has called on UK businesses to prepare for such an eventuality. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Political commentator Mick Napier joins me now from Edinburgh. Welcome back to the program. So all these latest murmurings suggest a possible deal. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's very conflicted. There are murmurings, but the murmurings seem to change almost every few hours. And the evaluation coming from Brussels is a little bit different from that coming from London. Look, it seems as if it's more than 4 years since the referendum, or as you know, people were calling it at one stage the Neverendum. And it seems to be a game of chicken. We're going up to the wire as a matter of hours. We've passed one deadline after another. Is it a game of chicken? But there are serious consequences here. Boris Johnson must be between a very hard rock and a very difficult alternative. He made a career, you have to remember, in Brussels, demonizing Brussels to his own party membership. So the elements who are really hostile to Brussels are of his own making. On the other hand, the Society of British Motor Manufacturers are terrified of the idea of no deal, where components for cars finally assembled in the UK might cross European border 4 or 5 times. They're genuinely afraid of what this will mean for them. The pound is down, suggesting that no deal is more likely, but nobody really knows. They say there can be no the British say that no extension is possible, no further extension. But, you know, everybody knows that when Boris Johnson says something, you have to take it with a very large pinch of salt. Right. He really is in a difficult situation between his hardliners and the Society of Motor Manufacturers.
Like you just said, a no deal looks very likely. But in the event there is a deal, it'll probably come if either side makes a compromise. If the UK were to be the side that does that, to compromise, how do you think it's going to play with the ardent Brexiteers in this country, the likes of Nigel Farage?
Not just Farage, but the little Farages inside the Conservative Party. I mean, Johnson has shown that when it push comes to shove, he's quite prepared to betray his allies. For example, the Northern Irish Unionists were reassured by him that there would never be a border down the Irish Sea, and then Johnson made a very swift about change and accepted it. So nobody knows if he will betray, if he'll turn on his very ardent Brexiteers. But as I say, nobody knows, because he has created this mood inside the Conservative Party where the feeling is extremely strong against any deal with Brussels. But on the other hand, he's under tremendous pressure. Remember, this is a man who, I'm not going to swear on your programme, but he basically said to business, to hell with business. And this is very strange from a Conservative Party leader who has to navigate between his own party rank and file, traditionally very pro-business, and now balance that against the needs of manufacturing in Britain. It's too close to hell. Very dramatic and past the breach.
Let me ask you one final question quickly. You're from Scotland. If Brexit happens to undermine the economy there, could you see another push at independence?
It's not whether I can see it. The numbers are piling up for independence in a way that most people who want independence didn't even dream of before. You know the story of the two guys running away from a lion, and one says, we'll never make it. One says to the other, I only have to run faster than you. All that the independence movement in Scotland has to do is continue to appear better than Johnson over COVID, over many, many, and they are looking better. Such is the hostility to Johnson and the Conservative government that he is pushing many Scots towards independence, and many members of his own party are suggesting that he has been reckless and threatens to bring the United Kingdom crashing down.
McNapier in Edinburgh, thank you so much. And now to other news. UN Atomic Watchdog Chief Rafael Grossi has called for fresh negotiations on the Iran nuclear deal after U.S. President-elect Joe Biden made rejoining the agreement a priority for his administration. Iran has stayed in the 2015 deal, also known as the JCPOA, but has scaled back some of its commitments after Washington withdrew. Tehran says it'll return to full compliance if the other signatories to the accord live up to their commitments. But it has ruled out any further negotiations to change the nature of the deal, which was originally agreed in 2015. Following the illegal assassination of Iran's top scientist, a Western media-sanctioned psychological warfare campaign has been launched through the dissemination of false claims against Iran. Here is Robert Inlakesh with more.
In the wake of the Israeli assassination of Iran's top scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Western governments and media are yet to actively condemn the terrorist attack which took place in Tehran. Many analysts speculate that the respective actions of the media have acted to exacerbate regional tensions rather than de-escalate the situation following the Israeli aggression against Iran.
Western governments, therefore, by refusing to condemn these acts, they're supporting them. And the Western media is also supporting them by trying to legitimize them. And the reason is because Iran has an independent foreign policy and because Iran opposes apartheid in Palestine.
Following the Israeli regime-sponsored act of terrorism in Tehran, it has been argued that Israel is now using psychological warfare as a means of getting at Iran, with the claims of an Iranian Quds Force commander having been killed along the Iraq-Syria border, a claim unsubstantiated, yet still published in the international press.
This so-called Iranian commander that they've given a name to, where is he from? What city is he from? Whenever an Iranian is hurt or injured in Syria or in Iraq, in the fight against ISIS, or martyred in the fight against ISIS, it people find out within an hour or two in Iran, because they have online accounts, they're online, their friends tell their families. It becomes news in Iran very quickly.
The claim originated first in Syrian opposition media outlet known as Step News Agency. The story was changed several times before it was picked up by Israeli media. Before long, Saudi-owned Al Arabiya News had cited an unnamed source providing a name to the commander allegedly killed. Later, Reuters, the Daily Mail, and RT even picked up on these claims, showing how far false information can spread based upon no more than allegations sourced from untrusted news outlets with political agendas. For long, Israeli strikes conducted against sovereign nations have gone underreported and have skipped condemnation from Western nations, sparking the criticism that the international community operates on double standards. Robert in Lakesh, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has picked a Native American named Deb Haaland to become Secretary of the Interior. If confirmed, Haaland will be the first Native American to serve in a cabinet position. More on that now from Robert in Lakesh. And Robert, about time, too.
Well, it seems that this is the most progressive right-wing, left-wing cabinet in history. I mean, it's a good thing on its face that it has been, or the government that he's building does have, you know, diversity in it. However, if we're looking at the policy positions of all of these individuals, or the majority of them, they're with the status quo. I mean, Joe Biden is not offering health care for all. He's not offering a difference in foreign policy. There's nothing substantial that he's really going to change, nothing fundamental that he's going to change. I mean, he's got Antony Blinken as Secretary of State. He'll be managing the foreign policy. He's, of course, in line with the neoliberal train of thought that thinks that attacking Syria and destroying Iraq are good things, destroying Libya was a good thing, sanctioning different countries around the world is a good thing. So this sort of woke imperialism, as it's being framed as, is not really much of a change. The whole entire point of having a diverse government is that it represents a diverse set of opinions, right, not just different colored faces there, so that they can claim that people of color that are in government are doing something to change anything. We saw this with Barack Obama. What did he change? There's no point having people of color in positions in government if they don't represent people of color.
Right. And how has social media reacted to this nomination?
The first one we've got here is from a Twitter user called Mike. He says, "How wonderful, you destroy their entire country, take the land, mass murder them, and then get applauded by your peers for being woke when you give one a job in your government imposed over them." Then we got another one here as well from Joe, who says, "I feel like there's a connotation of ignorance attached. It's like poser progressive or fake progressive, someone who gets most of their info from memes. I'd hardly call Biden woke."
All right, let's move on to your second story. The U.S. feeling challenged by China and Russia?
So the United States is pursuing an escalatory strategy with China. It seems that they will be attempting to assert their dominance in the South China Sea. And then when it comes to Russia also, what should be noted is Trump's withdrawal from missile treaties with Russia, which, and of course, starting this new arms race, as it's been dubbed. And we've seen just in the past few weeks many different steps that have been taken. For instance, when it comes to Turkey purchasing the S-400 air defense systems from Russia, they have been sanctioned for this. And the United States is not stopping this assertive sort of imperialistic stance that they're taking, which is really ushering in a new Cold War phase that we're entering. And on top of that, Australia, it seems to be being used as the attack dog of the United States when it comes to China.
And the online reaction to this story, Robert?
The first one we've got here says, "Apes adopt more assertive postures, and so do hooligans in bar fights. I don't think that approach is all too effective on a nation-to-nation level. Deeds, not postures." And then we got another one here from Coolio. Twitter user who says, China has much more of a claim to be there than we do. It'd be like Russia putting aircraft carriers in the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, this is a reference to the South China Sea.
All right, Robert and Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And now to other stories. Russian President Vladimir Putin has blamed the United States for starting a new arms race, saying Moscow has been forced to develop hypersonic weapons as a response.
Once the U.S. left the anti-ballistic missile treaty, it all began. One country is building a nuclear umbrella for itself, so what will be the result? The result is the nullification of our nuclear potential. We had to do everything to prevent this. We had to create an anti-missile defense system or a system which can override their nuclear umbrella, and that's what we did.
The Russian president was speaking at his annual media news conference where journalists and media representatives were able to put their questions to him directly. Putin also touched on the situation between Armenia and Azerbaijan in Nagorno-Karabakh, as well as the alleged poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, which he described as a ploy to attack Russia. Sweden's King Carl XVI Gustav says his country has failed in its handling of the coronavirus pandemic. Sweden, which has never imposed a full lockdown, has seen nearly 350,000 cases